second matter on our calendar today. Thanks so much to the lawyers for coming forward. Take a moment, get settled. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. While you're settling in, we'll just take a few care of a few housekeeping matters. So, Marshall, would you call the second case, please?
Case A24-0951, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Joseph Sean Anthony Porter, Appellant.
All right, and counsel, I'll remind you of a few things that you're probably well aware of, but just to have everything clear, so you probably are aware that today's proceedings are being aired via Zoom. Secondly, we maintain an audio recording of today's proceedings, so in keeping with that, I ask you to do a couple of things. The court asks you to do a couple of things. First of all, when you get to the podium, before you begin your remarks or argument, if you would identify yourself as well as the client you represent so our record can be clear. And then we very much look forward to the conversation with you today. I will note that, you know, we do have the timekeeping parameters that you're well aware of, so please keep an eye on the clock. The time tends to go quickly, and we do look forward to talking to you. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Evan Ottaviani, and I represent the appellant, Joseph Porter. We are asking this court to grant Mr. Porter a new trial. This case involves a prosecutorial conflict of interest. The state of Minnesota brought a prosecution against Mr. Porter in which a sitting judge was the named victim. That judge had an influential role in the bringing of charges, and the case was charged and tried by a lawyer who had one-third of his cases before that judge. This was a recognized conflict under the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct and a violation of Mr. Porter's due process rights. Allowing the prosecutor to continue...
Counsel, was a complaint filed with the Office of Lawyers for First Responsibility?
No, Your Honor. Okay. Allowing the prosecutor to continue to prosecute this case was structural error. The prosecutor represents the executive branch of the state of Minnesota. That agency has an interest in the faithful execution of the laws of this state, including an interest in seeing that all those charged with criminal offenses are treated fairly and equally. This prosecutor also represents the people of Chisago County. They have the same interest in seeing the laws fairly and equally enforced.
Can you address the threshold question of whether this matter is this legal issue is properly before us, and if not, why we should consider it if it hasn't been preserved by raising it in the district court?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It has been preserved. The facts before this court, the legal considerations are the same. The facts that we rely on were the facts that were relied on by the district court. And then the issue that we present today was that Mr. Porter was treated unfairly and that this was a conflict under the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct. I would point to the fact that in district court, it was the defense counsel who attempted to supplement the record with additional information that could be used. Both the district court and the state called that a fishing expedition. So to the extent that the state would want the introduction of any additional information, the defense counsel at trial as well as now, we are relying on the same facts, making the same argument that this attorney was conflicted under the rules of professional conduct. Now, within that conflict, there is constitutional questions that this court should address. Those constitutional questions extend from the interests of the state of Minnesota. We can point to the Minnesota Constitution that the executive branch has a duty to see that the laws are faithfully executed. That's in Section 3. I would point out Section 6 then makes clear that the Constitution is implicated in that duty to see that the laws are faithfully executed. So those issues, I do believe, are preserved. Additionally, the criminal law has consistently pointed to the interest of justice as an exception to any failure to raise an issue at the trial court level. Again, this issue was raised at the trial court level, so we're not at this point. But if we were, I believe the interest of justice...
Is a constitutional question?
So the defense counsel pointed out that Mr. Porter was being treated unfairly in district court. I believe that implicates directly the state of Minnesota executive branch's requirement to see that the laws are faithfully executed. And that would be fair and equal
execution. I understand it might implicate the issue of the Constitution, but don't you have to raise a specific constitutional issue in order to preserve that issue? I mean, except, of course, for the interest of justice exception.
Right, and so here, there's two issues that Your Honor is bringing up. There's the one that would be the interest of justice exception, which I can get to. There's the other, which is whether or not it was included in the issue that was raised at the district court level. I would say it is because, one, it is incorporated underneath the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct. If a prosecutor is prosecuting a case considering the interests of his own personal interests or the interests of a third party, that would implicate then a violation of his duties to the state of Minnesota.
I mean, a hearsay objection implicates the confrontation clause. That doesn't create a confrontation clause issue that's been preserved in appeal. If you could assume, just for the sake of my question, I'm not speaking on behalf of the panel, but just assume we have to get to the interest of justice question in order to address that issue in appeal. Maybe you could discuss
that. And I just want to clarify that the argument we raise on the professional conduct would be thoroughly preserved under this line of argument. It's just in the constitutional question. So addressing the constitutional question under the interest of justice, one, we posit that this is structural error. That analysis would then supersede this question in general. Two, this is an important issue that this court should address.
Are you suggesting every issue that could be addressed under the structural error analysis is automatically preserved or included in the interest of justice exception?
I'm saying if it is structural error, then we have case law that says, you know, short of Polsinski, which, you know, it's a invited error case, those structural error cases are unobjected to issues. So if we're following that case law, then yes, I would agree with that. But back to the interest of justice, I think that the prejudice to either party is an important piece of this analysis, as well as the facts that would be relevant to the issue. So the facts here, as I mentioned, have been thoroughly raised and presented. There is no prejudice to the state. One, because the state was the one trying to limit the record in district court, the defense counsel was the one trying to expand that to additional information. So I believe the interest of justice exception is thoroughly met here for those reasons. So moving on to our constitutional argument, this implicates what right Mr. Porter has to the fair-minded exercise of prosecutorial discretion. So this dovetails very closely with the analysis under the Rules of Professional Conduct. Because the Rules of Professional Conduct, what they're looking at is whether or not there are personal or third-party interests that would influence this prosecutor's ability to consider this case, and whether it would foreclose alternative avenues that the prosecutor could follow. We know this is true here by looking at a number of decisions that were made. First and foremost, at the initiation of the case, this judge had an influential role in that. The investigator testified at trial. He was told that the judge would contact him if she wanted to move forward with the case. The judge herself testified at trial that she was going to make the decision whether to prosecute was the word that she used. This case was then prosecuted and tried by an attorney who appeared in front of her.
Help me out, counsel. I read that argument in your brief. Explain to me how that is a concurrent conflict of interest under Rule 1.7.
So that would be due to the relationship that this prosecutor has with that judge. This is a judge he appears in front of regularly, whose interests he would implicitly recognize as important due to, again, one-third of his caseload being in front of a judge he regularly appears in front of.
And it's maybe so obvious to you, but it's not to me. So the client that the prosecuting attorney has represented is the same. I mean, there's no set of clients here, right? There is one client. State of Minnesota, right? The people of Minnesota.
As well as more narrow within the Chisago County Attorney's Office. I think there are degrees and the rules kind of get into that, you know, those
but represent. So draw out for me where the conflict of interest is. You know, even if you want to start with the investigation or with the decision to bring charges or go to the trial, the obligation to present a fair trial, where's the conflict?
So the conflict is that the state of Minnesota, the executive branch, has an interest in seeing that the laws are enforced the same among anyone in Minnesota who's charged with a criminal offense. The interests of a victim who happens to be the third party in this case, again, there's no client relationship there. It's the third party is the victim who is the judge this attorney appears in front of. her interests in this case are to see that it is prosecuted and that my client is convicted. Those are different interests.
Enforcement of the law, right? Which is what you told me, I think.
Correct.
The obligation.
In a very narrow sense, yes, because she is a victim. Her rights have been violated. That does not dovetail with the state of Minnesota's interests in a more disinterested ability to look at the cases. And then I think this actually is maybe more relevant getting into our next issue, which is the relevance of the conflict at the plea bargaining and sentence recommendation stages. We can look at case law that says that how important these things are. So Gander v. Payton is a Fourth Circuit case. It's relatively old, from 1967. It's cited in the brief. But in that case, the prosecutor is representing the wife of the defendant. That case specifically points out how important just the influence of the interests of that wife could be on the plea bargaining stage. And I would point to that section of that case for this court to focus on. It points out that even if she wasn't involved in the initial decision to prosecute the case, her interests could have been influential and limited plea bargaining. Here, of course, we have the facts mentioned in our brief, which is that the initial offer that was made was an illegal offer because there had been no aggravating factors submitted to the court. However, the plea offer was to an aggravated durational departure.
Do you agree with the argument made in respondents, or would you comment on the argument made in respondents' brief that there was a subsequent plea offer made?
I do.
After not include that aggravated factor.
That was after the district court had indicated that it wouldn't have accepted that sentence because it was an illegal sentence.
Right.
But I do agree that a subsequent plea offer was made. I would note that that offer corresponds to the sentencing recommendation, which is at the top of the box.
Okay, so I guess what I'm trying to do is track your argument with the language of comment 8 in rule 1.7, right? So 1.7 is the professional rule of conduct that you've cited to us as saying it demonstrates the prosecuting attorney's conflict of interest, and comment 8 was also cited in your brief as to help us identify what the conflict is, and specifically says mere possibilities of subsequent harm do not require disclosure and consent, in other words, aren't conflicts. And the questions are likelihood of a difference in interests and then whether those difference in interests materially interfere with the lawyer's independent judgment. So draw that out for me in this plea bargaining example.
And so the difference of interest then would be that my client's receiving a similar plea offer that any defendant would receive in a criminal case. Here, this
and
plea
what
offer...
And what is the difference? I'm just not following. I'm sorry. Because he did get two offers, one with the aggravating factor assumed and one without, so...
Right, and it's not... So then the question here is then getting to the second part of that comment that Your Honor is focusing on, whether it will materially interfere with the lawyer's independent professional judgment in considering alternatives or foreclose courses of action. So, for instance, the defense attorney at trial pointed out that this could be considered a less egregious offense. This was a threat made through the mail. There was no waving of a weapon or brandishing. This was no in-person threat. So the prosecutor's ability to see the case in that lens appears to have been interfered with here by his quote. You know, he saw this as a particularly egregious case. We know from looking at the record that his offer did not change upon introduction of those facts from the defense attorney, that kind of consideration. It was because the judge had indicated he would not be willing to agree to the plea offer that was made. That, to me, does not indicate any kind of recognition, a disinterested recognition that this case warranted a lesser recommendation. And then the initial recommendation that was made, as well as the sentencing recommendation that's at the top of the box, so the most severe sentence my client could have received, was the one recommended by this prosecutor who saw this case as, quote-unquote, particularly egregious.
Counsel, one question I have is, and I admit that we don't know the answer to this, but why do you think another prosecutor would treat this case any more lightly? I mean, this is a serious threat to a sitting judge, and that would be considered serious, I think, by most prosecutors. So where are we on this? What personal interest about this prosecutor, other than appearing in court occasionally in front of that judge, would lead us to believe that prosecutor is acting in a manner different than any other prosecutor?
Yeah, and I think I can respond to that by pointing out the additional facts that were true in this case because of the prosecutor's relationship with this judge. This is a judge this prosecutor regularly appeared in front of. There were two other judges who also recused themselves from this case. There's a public defender's office who recused themselves from this case. So all indications seem to be that the people involved in Chisago County understood that they had some sort of personal connection. And I would highlight the fact that the public...
I don't track that. I mean, these individuals have different roles. We're talking about the prosecutor.
And I think then highlighting the public defense decision to recuse themselves, they have interest to their client, and even they understood that they regularly appear in front of this judge, and that regular appearance relationship may hinder their ability to represent the interests of their clients. I think that is very similar to a prosecutor who is obligated to...
The objective for a defense attorney in the relationship differs from the prosecutor to the state.
And I think this gets into the second part of what I was going to say, which is the importance of the reputational and professional interests here of any attorney who's appearing regularly in a courtroom. The legal community is a relatively small community, and this is a smaller community within the Chisago County Attorney's Office, or sorry, Chisago County Court. These are attorneys who regularly see each other on a daily basis, and would be the ones, as I mentioned in my brief, to offer any kind of recommendation in the future and to just generally comment on their kind of aptitude at the profession. So it's very important that this prosecutor do a good job in this case. And a good job in this case likely means pleasing a judge he's regularly appearing in front of. So those personal interests are incredibly important here. And that would be an important distinction between any prosecutor throughout the state of Minnesota. And I see my time is up, if I may continue
answering. You can go ahead and conclude.
Yeah. Between any prosecutor in the state of Minnesota who, yes, might see this case, rightly so, as an important one. And that only raises the stakes on how important their disinterestedness is. And in this case, we have a prosecutor who regularly appeared in front of this judge, who saw this judge in the courthouse, who likely had some degree of a personal relationship just from the day-to-day interactions that they have. He appeared in front of two other judges. So this seems to indicate this is a regular relationship. And that would significantly distinguish, I believe, this prosecutor's representation in seeing this case as particularly egregious from another prosecutor who may also see the case as serious.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, so if you choose.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Tom Garrett's on behalf of the state of Minnesota by and through Chisago County, Minnesota, the Chisago County Attorney's Office. My position is a conflict of interest is not created by a, quote, regular appearance relationship between the prosecutor and a victim judge. There was not a conflict of interest in this case such that the Chisago County Attorney's Office should have removed itself. And the Chisago County Attorney's Office did not prejudice the appellant in any meaningful or appreciable way.
Counsel, I'm going to just ask this question, which I think, I don't know if the record is going to reflect an answer to this. And I acknowledge, as Judge Ross has pointed out, the different roles between a judge, a prosecutor, and a defense attorney. But it appeared the Supreme Court was quick to appoint a judge from outside of the district, and defense attorneys came in from outside the county. Chisago County could have recused itself, the county attorney's office.
Yes. Okay. I don't think there's any reasonable way to dispute that, Your Honor.
Okay. Is there any record in the record as to why they did not?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor. I don't recall telling the court, the district court, why our office had decided not to recuse itself. And so I don't think it's okay. In there. I would only be able to tell the court myself. So regarding not prejudicing the appellant, he was sentenced to a guideline sentence. So even if, and again, I would dispute it, but even if we assumed that there was some kind of, nefarious thing going on, the defendant was sentenced to a guideline sentence. So to speak, the damages were mitigated. There weren't any. He received a guideline sentence. It was top of the range, admittedly. But I think the argument that he was given an illegal sentence, which I believe was in the appellant's brief, is overwrought. An illegal sentence would be beyond the statutory maximum. The statutory maximum is 5 years. He was sentenced to 18. So not only was it within the stat max, it was within the range. But that's conceding that there was a conflict, which I don't.
And you appreciate, of course, that the argument from appellant is that the appellant need not prove prejudice because this is structural error.
Yeah, I understand the argument.
And again, we're all skipping. My question skipped past whether there was a conflict of interest. But if you just assume that for the moment and comment on the structural error argument.
So I would argue there was not structural error because to show structural error, there would need to be something indicating such a beyond the pale attempt by the state such that the defendant received, like, we can't believe that he had a fair trial. Like, reviewing it, you know, I always think of the best example I have in mind is always closing the courtroom, right? Because then the public can't even see what's happening. Whenever the court does that, they have to make specific findings about it to allow it, because otherwise the trust of the public in the proceedings is undermined. For me to look at this case and think this is in the same ballpark as the court closing a courtroom, I cannot fathom those being remotely comparable simply based on a frequent appearance relationship. That's way too strong a comparison. And on top of that,
is that how we look at structural error, though, counsel? Do we look at it in the context of the specific example? So here it would be this frequent appearance in front of the judge who was also the victim in the case, or do we look at it more at the level of this attacks the fairness of the proceedings because we now, again, I'm assuming a disqualification, but we have a case fully tried by a prosecutor that had a conflict of interest that affected their independent judgment?
Certainly. So,
yeah. And if we assume that, then do we get to structural error? And I guess the analogy I'd ask you to draw, it's the one that was written about in an appellant's brief, is that if we put a judge in that position, so say a judge with it somehow a pecuniary interest in the case that somehow arises later, you know, not during the course of the proceedings, there isn't a motion to disqualify, would that be structural error?
So if I'm correct, please, Your Honor, correct me if I'm not following it, but I'm not exactly sure about the subsequent
pecuniary
interest and how that could affect it. But I think that a frequent, if I remember the argument correctly, saying that the state has an interest in impressing the judge because of potential future career advancement and pleasing a judge, this seems like a very minimal attempt by offering a departure or an upward aggravated departure of 21 months over 18 months. If we're really considering that sufficient evidence just by itself, how is a 3-month departure upward sufficient to claim that or say?
If I'm not mistaken, I think you're arguing the question of whether the error, if there was one, prejudiced the appellant, which I thought the question that you were addressing, the issue that you were trying to address, is the impact of a potential, whether there's a potential structural error. My understanding of structural error is you don't need to show any prejudice or harm. You just have to show that there was something in the structure of the case that would indicate a potential unfairness, so that you don't have to actually show prejudice. For example, if it turned out that the judge in the case was turned out to be a relative of the victim, and we'd say, well, we don't have to show it. So what if the defendant got a guideline sentence? It was a structural error for that judge to sit on the case because it implicates the potential fairness of the proceeding. I think that's how you address a structural error. Even so, if there is in fact a conflict of interest that amounts to an unfairness, it wouldn't matter whether there was a guideline sentence or not. Correct me if you think I'm wrong.
I follow the court. I follow it. So I think then it really would be up to this court to decide that that's structural error. I would say there hasn't been any case law indicating that. I mean, a judge being a relative of a victim, presiding over the trial where that victim was the one harmed, that seems on its face, we don't need to decide if the court, you know, or we don't need to figure out if that presiding judge met with the victim to say, what kind of sentence would you feel good about me giving? We don't need to show that because the very possibility undermines the people's trust in the fairness of the proceedings. But to then take that example and say, well, this prosecutor appears in front of that judge a third of the time, assuming that's the percentage, I don't even know how often I appear in front of Judge Trevino. But even assuming that it's a third of the time, that seems very far apart from a judge presiding over a criminal case where their niece is the victim. That by itself, the people would say, I can't possibly be convinced that defendant got a fair trial. But it would be up to this court to decide that. I don't know what factors there are to say, well, that's structural error because we can't trust the fairness of the proceedings, and that one's not structural error because we can. It really is up to the court to say that.
It's a legal question, though, isn't it? It's not one that would vary from case to case. If it turns out a prosecutor, if it's true that a prosecutor involved in a case in which there's a conflict of interest is a structural error, then it would be a structural error in every case where that legal conclusion is reached, right?
Right. I would agree, Your Honor.
So we have a legal question in front of us. First, a couple. One, was there a conflict of interest? If so, is it a structural error in a circumstance where it's a prosecutorial prosecutor and victim relationship that creates the conflict? I think those are the legal questions. And so is there case law on either of those that you would rely upon for us to rule in the state's favor?
Your Honor, I would say I don't know of any other than the ones I cited in the briefs, which were only analogous. And then the appellant did argue the Young v. U.S. ex rel. Vitan, but in that case, a private prosecutor was appointed who represented Louis Vuitton. Like, that was their client. And then they were prosecuting out the contempt of court. And that is a case that's so clearly distinguishable from this one that I think it's in favor of ruling in the state, ruling for the state. Here, the comparisons being made, I would say there is not a conflict of interest, and if there is, it's not structural error, because it doesn't rise to the level of, on its face, undermining trustworthiness of the judicial procedure. And so prosecuting for the benefit of a client, essentially enforcing a court's trademark protection order, that's for the benefit of a client. In this case, we're simply charging out an offense that occurred in Chisago County. That's it. And then as far as the offer being for an upward aggravated departure, yes, it was before a notice of seeking an aggravated departure had been filed, but that didn't make it an illegal offer. I think that's an overwrought characterization of the offer. It doesn't make it an illegal one. It just makes it an offer that occurred before the notice was filed. If there's a rule that said you can't send that notice or that offer until you filed a notice, then that would be a fair argument. But that there's no rule that says that. It's not an illegal offer prior to filing a notice of seeking an aggravated departure.
And I think I understand your argument on that, counsel. I guess what I would appreciate hearing is your response to the appellant's argument that set of plea offers, because apparently there were two that are presented to us. I believe they're both in the record. That those, or at least the parties agree that they occurred as a matter of record, that those plea offers were given by a prosecuting attorney whose independent professional judgment was impaired or likely impaired because of this frequent appearance. So I'd like you to shift over and talk specifically about appellant's arguments for why there is a conflict of interest.
Sure. So I don't think there's sufficient evidence to make that claim. The state's position at the time of that offer, which was explained to Judge Castro at the trial level, was that we believed it was particularly egregious to threaten a judge in that way, to threaten a judge at all. I mean, the overwhelming evidence in support of guilt was it was so clear a threat, and it was directed at a judge that this defendant had appeared in front of on a prior case, that was the reason for given by the state to the court for its offer above the guideline range. And so to presume prosecutor conflict of interest, which I think is essentially what's being requested here, a presumption of prosecutorial conflict of interest. And I don't think A, we should be operating with a presumption of prosecutorial interest unless we're talking about a Young versus U.S. ex rel. Vatan situation, or I forget which case was cited by the appellant, where the prosecutor was handling the cases of his creditors. That I can't argue against that. Of course not.
Are cases, then, I gather you're acknowledging the relationship between the prosecutor and the defendant, or the relationship between the prosecutor and the victim, might have some bearing on how the prosecutor approaches the case, including whether to provide more or less lenient or stringent plea offers.
Yeah, I can't in good faith argue to this court that a pecuniary interest like that does not.
Not a pecuniary interest necessarily. There are other relationship type interests that might influence.
Pecuniary or familiar are as far as I would be willing to go. And because this is merely on a regular appearance basis, I can't agree to that. I think that's way too thin. So, I mean, the consequences
so
of that position.
Literally family interest.
Family,
not
correct.
Good friend. So if the prosecutor had a really close friend who is a victim and wants to hammer the defendant and not offer lenient plea agreement opportunities, there's no conflict of interest there from your viewpoint. No potential for it.
I couldn't give the court a black and white answer to that, but I understand the point. Like, it's a fair point. If I let's say, because I'm meeting one after this, if a judge and I had been friends since we were 7 years old, it'd be hard for me to argue this to this court that there isn't a conflict there. But let's say we'd known each other and
judge as victim.
Correct. If it was a judge as victim and I'd known them since they were seven, even then, I would argue, Your Honor, as I'm thinking about it out loud, I would still argue they need to show more than just they've known each other since they were seven. Structural error, we don't need to show anything else. I think that's excessive. Plus, the consequences of that position.
I think you're jumping in your analysis.
Sorry.
You wouldn't necessarily say, okay, that's a structural error. The question is that a conflict of interest? And then the question is, does that type of conflict of interest constitute a structural error? I think there are two steps in the analysis, and you're
certainly
merging the two.
I would say I don't think, even if they hadn't been friends with a victim judge since they were seven, I don't think that's enough in and of itself to say conflict of interest can't trust the case. But if the court decided that, it'd be hard for me to disagree because, I mean, at age 42, that's a 35-year friendship. I could see that. But let's say they'd known each other since they were seven, and then hadn't seen each other for the prior 25 years, then what? I would say that finding a conflict of interest here would have very far-reaching consequences. That would mean that if a Chisago County Sheriff's deputy is the victim of a crime in Chisago County, we can't charge that out because we work with them all the time. They're our largest law enforcement agency. Why does it stop at a victim judge? It should include victim court personnel for Chisago County. It should include victim law enforcement from Lakes Area Police Department, Wyoming Police Department. It includes lots of people, a big donor from Chisago County to political campaigns.
Thank you.
I think a frequent appearance relationship is just way too thin without more evidence.
So, Counselor,
now my time is up. I'm sorry.
Your time is up, but okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
I just want to touch on a few points that were introduced there. This was structural error. I would point to two cases, Greer, which was cited in our brief, as well as Young v. United States. Greer gives rationales. There's three of them for structural error. This court should consider fundamental fairness, the difficulty with which the error is to measure, as well as whether the error would protect, the interest protected would go beyond erroneous conviction. I believe that all three of those are relevant in this case.
Let's assume that there's a conflict here. So provide for us, I mean, this is a novel situation. Why don't you provide for us the rule of law? Assume we're going to rule in your favor, decide this case in your favor. What is the bright line rule of law or the standard rule of law that we would include so that other prosecutors in the future and judges in the district court will know the right course to take?
I would say when a prosecutor's fair-minded exercise of prosecutorial discretion is or appears to be limited by a third party or personal interest.
When you say appears to be, well, in this case, we don't know. I mean, how do you make that determination? So what, narrow that rule of law to the facts to the facts of this case so that it's really clear what a court's supposed to do.
Absolutely. And I just want to make sure I get this out. The authority for that is within Young v. United States. That's an important piece that they consider, is the appearance of impropriety and the public's perception of the fairness of the criminal justice system. That's why I think this is a very important
piece. No, I understand that, but I'm
piece.
Trying to apply
yes.
those standards
I just wanted to say that so that
to
I didn't
this case
leave
to create,
that off.
To create
Absolutely.
A rule of law
Absolutely.
From this case that future prosecutors and district court judges can act on.
Yeah, and so I think there's two pieces to that. One of those is looking at specifically what happened in the case itself. So if there is reason to believe, based on the facts of the case, that the prosecutor's ability to fairly and disinterestedly consider the evidence was impacted by a personal interest or a relationship with a third party, that's relevant.
I'm asking you for specific to this case.
Yes.
Reason to believe that. So you want us to hold in this case that in every circumstance in which X happens, there is reason to believe, and therefore a conflict of interest. So tell us what the X is.
And I'm not asking for something as broad as that. I'm asking for a narrow finding on these facts. And so the rule of law would be specific to these facts. And so the relevant facts in this case would be the judge's involvement in the initial charging decision, the initial plea offer, and the final sentencing recommendation. I think also relevant to that is the state's perception of the defense request for discoveries being a fishing expedition, the district court finding there. That's not as important. However, that does, I think, impact the facts that now exist in front of this court for when this court is relying. You know, again, I would point out that the state uses this sufficient evidence wording a lot. To the extent that the evidence wouldn't be sufficient, which I believe it is, but they were the ones making the argument that this was a fishing expedition. So I think that's a relevant consideration here as well.
It doesn't sound like a rule of law.
And so my rule of law would then get back to this is mostly describing the appears to be part of this. So when an initial plea offer or sentencing recommendation or initial charging decisions appear to be influenced by a third party, that is an indication that the prosecutor's fair-minded exercise of prosecutorial discretion was impacted to such an extent that under the rules of professional conduct as well as my client's due process rights were impacted. So then getting to Young v. United States, they also have three important considerations for why this is structural error. One of those is improper influence causes the judiciary to lose faith in the proceedings, as well as is it pervasive throughout the proceedings. Here we know it was. Again, charging, plea, sentencing, the influence was present through all of those. I also want to point out in Sirstock, the issue was not that he handled the tickets of his creditors favorably. The issue was that he handled them at all. That's what the district court said, this court said. I also want to highlight this slippery slope argument that is made by the prosecutor. Again, I think this can be a narrow, fact-specific case, so we are not commenting on the Chisago County Deputy's Office or any other law enforcement. However, if there was an indication that, you know, they worked closely with one person daily, certainly that could rise to the level of improper influence on the prosecutor. And if there are no more questions, we would ask this court to vacate Mr. Porter's conviction and remand for a new trial.
We don't have any questions for you, counsel. Thanks very much. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. The matter was well briefed and well argued, and we appreciate having a conversation with you today. It's now submitted to the court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeline. So thank you. And with that, our proceedings are concluded, our oral matters are concluded, and we will be in recess for our non-oral.